Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a post-mortem on the defeat for Labor and the Democrats as the state of Michigan, the birthplace of the labor movement, became the 24th state to adopt the anti-union right-to-work law. A specialist on labor at UC Berkeley, Dr. Harley Shaken, joins us to examine how the Republicans snookered labor and the Democrats and what can be done to reverse the situation. Then we'll look into the latest successful missile test by North Korea that has boosted the prestige of the emperor-like boy leader whose subjects are dancing with joy in the streets. Sumi Terry joins us. She was the Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. While China has appealed for calm, we will discuss the reasons why China protects the family dynasty that rules this erratic failed state on its border. Then finally, we will speak with a general who wants to cut the Pentagon budget that has been largely exempt from alarm over the so-called fiscal cliff. General Robert Gard, the chairman of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and a former executive assistant to two secretaries of defense, joins us to discuss the low-hanging fruit that could be easily cut from the bloated defense budget and would improve the nation's national security and economic health. And joining us now is Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Harley Shaken.
It's nice to be here.
And what just happened in Michigan, making Michigan the cradle, if you will, of American labor, the birthplace of the United Auto Workers, in many ways the kind of crucible of the American middle class. Nevertheless, the Republican-controlled legislature and the governor just signed a right-to-work bill making Michigan the 24th state in the United States to have these right-to-work bills, which, of course, again, are misleadingly labeled. They sound like they're about freedom, which is the argument that the Republicans make, but really they're about cutting off the oxygen to the Democratic Party, defunding them via the ruse of allowing members of labor unions not to pay, in fact, making it a law that they don't have to pay dues, and they get benefits without having to pay for them. And of course, it is a fairly pretty clear what's going on here. How did they get so blindsided? How did they get so, why were they so wrong-footed on this one?
Well, I think you have it very right. This was an important blow to labor, particularly symbolically, given all the associations with Michigan and given what Michigan has meant nationally, not simply in terms of the United Auto Workers and other unions, but the middle class really expanded dramatically in the post-World War II period because of unions, and Michigan was the locus for a lot of that happening. What happened here on this right-to-work bill was, I think, the Democrats and labor itself were blindsided by a very bold Republican move. This wasn't an issue of voters in Michigan all of a sudden embracing the notion of right-to-work. This was legislation that was passed in a lame-duck session, under the dead of night with no debate, and the governor, who's been in office 2 years, his first term, who had said all along he wouldn't sign it, it was far too divisive for Michigan, he is a Republican, did an about-face and signed it. So we have the legislation. It's a blow to labor, to be sure, but it's not the end of the story. It's the beginning.
Well, it seems to me, Harley Shaken, without being too cynical, that Governor Snyder just snookered the Democrats and the labor unions in making those pledges. He was elected in 2010 with the Karl Rove-engineered sweep in the midterm elections that caught the Democrats by surprise. That was a strategic plan. I mean, you can almost hear what was said in the back rooms with Karl Rove doing a PowerPoint briefing with, along with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, funded by the American Petroleum Institute. What we're going to do is we're going to take over the state legislatures in all of the key swing states, and we're going to put in this model legislation designed to break unions so that we bankrupt unions, take away their money, which means we in turn take away the money that fuels the Democratic Party. And that way we will make ourselves the permanent majority. We'll control the swing states and we will defund the Democrats. The writing is on the wall. I mean, it's so clear that this is a strategic plan that has worked out extremely well.
Well, I think you're quite right that ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, a far-right legislative group with Koch brother money, among others, had a big hand in this. Planning on this specifically started in 2007. All that said, there may have been a Republican miscalculation on this as well. The governor was elected as a pragmatic problem solver. And the day after signing this, he looks like a right-wing ideologue who's creating a problem. That's not simply my perspective. The Detroit Free Press, one of the two most important papers in Michigan, who endorsed Governor Snyder for election and has supported him for much of the first 2 years, has done several blistering editorials calling the signing of this bill outrageous and saying he has betrayed the independents in the state. And there are hundreds of thousands of independents that were critical to his reelection. And this sense of fair play being thrown out the window could come back to haunt the governor and the legislators who voted for this. So labor isn't simply going to leave this alone. This is going to be central going forward, but it's not just labor. It's a broad swath of independents in the state who all of a sudden feel they were snookered and are confronting a governor who's not the tough nerd he portrayed himself to be, but is somebody who was able to do an about-face instantly and embrace something that is going to be very divisive in the state and quite counterproductive, I suspect, going forward.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Harley Shaken, who's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. And we're talking about how the Democrats and labor were caught by surprise in Michigan, where in a lame duck session, the Republican legislature pushed through in the dead of night. They locked the doors. They kept public comment out and pushed through these so-called right-to-work laws. And the governor just signed it, even though the entire congressional delegation, mostly Democrats, showed up and met with him prior to this. The president showed up as well and made the point that the right to work means the right to work for less money, and said that this is not about economics, this is all about politics. They couldn't have put this guy on more on notice. I'm sure the president, the White House, let the governor know that he's not going to get any cooperation from them in the next few years. And I'm sure the congressional delegation let him know that they're not going to get any cooperation.
The governor was stuck between a rock and a hard place. He was in danger of losing the far-right part of his base and important contributors. And if he went that route, which he did, he's got some even larger problems that he's going to face. I think he miscalculated how sensitive an issue this is in Michigan, not simply with union people, but more broadly how this would play with independents. The irony is that the president was coming to Michigan and was in Michigan several days ago to herald a new $100 million investment in a Chrysler plant, Detroit Diesel, which took place well before any right to work was on the horizon. The president said directly, as you pointed out, this is a political move. What it does is gives you the right to work for less. And I think it cannot be understood in any other way than as a lowball political move. November 6th, the president carried Michigan by 10 percentage points over Governor Romney, who was born and grew up in the state. Beyond that, the Democratic Senator, Debbie Stabenow, who was up for re-election, won re-election by even a broader margin over her conservative Republican opponent. So labor should have been celebrating because it played such a key role in these victories, and the Republican right seized the moment, but it can't be understood in any other way than a political victory. It could prove short-term.
Well, it seems to me that the roots of this right-to-work canard in American labor, obviously, it all first got its footing in the South. And, of course, if you go back to the Civil War, in many ways, that war was really about economics, not about the moral issue of slavery. I mean, you don't get people to go off and die for a moral issue. It's pretty hard, but you can certainly get people to go off and fight and die if their livelihood's at stake. And in many ways, the South has this feudal tradition, and the North, the Union, was both about keeping the U.S. together and also about, I think, about the idea of protecting workers' rights. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I suspect that this is a big part of it. And you have this kind of different culture down in the South, where they've invited all of these foreign auto companies in, et cetera, and they work for much less wages. So how do you overcome that? Because what's happening now is that Southern kind of feudal values, if you will, are spreading north here. And the North, particularly Michigan, was both where the slaves escaped to and was also where the UAW was founded. And an awful lot of African Americans moved from the South to Michigan and became a part of the middle class. So I see some really deep ironies in this.
Oh, there are many, many ironies. One of the ironies that has come out of this, and again, this is a narrow political move, it was played as right to work attracting business to the state. That is a very small factor, if a factor at all. But the real impact of this for both sides is it's perceived as a Trojan horse for further onslaughts against unions. One of the ironies is Governor Walker in Wisconsin was asked whether he thought right to work would be a good thing now in Wisconsin. He said, no, it would be too divisive. So if you've got Scott Walker saying something related to labor is too divisive, you understand this isn't the beginning of the end for unions in terms of right to work. Governor Corbett in Pennsylvania, same thing. But he's not by any means clamoring for this. Governor Kasich in Ohio, once again, he knows firsthand what a labor response can mean. So this could prove a costly victory. The symbolism is clear. It may be damaging, but it doesn't necessarily have to be damaging for labor in the short term. One out of every five people in Michigan is a union member. 28% of the voting public comes from union families. Labor has considerable resources and a critical mass, and I think this will galvanize a strong response. It won't even necessarily have a huge impact in terms of collecting of dues from people who decide not to pay dues. That's a real danger. We won't know till we see what happens over the next year or so. But in Las Vegas, the culinary workers in a right-to-work state have 98% of the people in the casinos they represent paying union dues. So there's a lot of imponderables here. It is damaging, but by no means immobilizing for unions. And the flip side is it could result in a revitalized labor movement and new links to non-union workers and to a broader community in Michigan that views this as a violation of democratic principles and as something that was a problem that was introduced, not solved.
So does that mean in the next 2 years, as the unions and the Democrats fight back against the Republicans and the governor and make life difficult for him, will this new law have an immediate effect on defunding the unions, which is the whole purpose of the law?
Absolutely. It could, but it doesn't necessarily have to. All this says is if you're in a union shop, and you don't want to pay union dues despite the fact that you're getting the benefits of that representation, that's up to you. It would be a little bit akin to giving citizens the right not to pay taxes if you elect a president you disagree with. Be that as it may, it doesn't mean that large numbers of workers will choose to do that. They could, but I suspect the unions and fellow workers on the shop floor, in the offices, in other areas will work very hard to avoid that taking place. Some of it, no doubt, will. We don't have a clear idea in a place like Michigan, where union density is so high, what's going to take place. If union density, that is the percent of the workforce that's in unions, was much lower, a right to work could have a much larger effect. But the impact, other than symbolic, is yet to be seen. But what we do know is, starting right now, unions are looking at court challenges, recall elections, ballot initiatives, and revisiting this in 2014 when the governor's up for re-election.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Holly Shaken, it seems to me, though, that the debate that we need to have here is we need to explore the thinking that goes on in this country that plutocrats like the Koch brothers exploit with this big lie that they put out about the billionaires and millionaires in this country being the job creators, and that corporations extort states and localities by getting huge tax breaks and threatening to leave if they don't get what they want. And a part of this whole thing that happened in Michigan was the idea that we've got to make conditions more favorable for employers, for corporations, acknowledging or preemptively rolling over for them, as though we in labor and as citizens and consumers have got to be nice to these powerful people, otherwise they'll pack up and leave us in the lurch. And there's also this notion out there of aspirational politics, that people, working class people who vote against their interests, are temporarily inconvenienced millionaires. And so I'm trying to figure out, I've always tried to figure out, since that book about What's the Matter with Kansas raised some of these questions, of why it is that this kind of thinking is so pervasive, and what's it going to take for people to recognize the folly and how much they're being conned by the people who already control the lion's share of our wealth and our political power in this country, the corporations.
Well, I think we've seen a growing frustration and anger over inequality in the U.S. We recently did a seminar on this here at Berkeley, and Emmanuel Saez, who is an economics professor here and a very well-regarded person on the issue of inequality, pointed out that the U.S. Around 2005 surpassed Argentina in terms of inequality and rivals Colombia, the most unequal country in South America, one of the most unequal countries in the world. It's not just inequality as an abstraction. It is the lack of mobility, the lack of opportunity, all the things that this builds into a society, including undermining democracy. So learning how to compete in the global economy, dealing with inequality are tough issues. And this move towards right to work, or right to work for less, as President Obama puts it, is a distraction at best, and really offers no alternatives for either a more successful state, the creation of jobs, or addressing the issue of inequality. It really requires redefining the debate as part of the process going forward.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Holly Shaken.
Nice talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Holly Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the successful launch of a North Korean missile that has North Koreans dancing in the streets.
There's power in a factory, power in the land. Power in the hand of the worker, but it all amounts to nothing if together.
senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar with the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you.
And 8 months ago, of course, a lot of people were sort of bemused by the failure of a North Korean launch, which many commentators suggested embarrassed the new young leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. However, whatever embarrassment he had last time, this time around, it appears to have been a successful launch. I believe the North Koreans are dancing in the streets.
Yes, they are very happy and excited about it. It seems like I am disappointed that Eunha 3, which is the same vehicle as really Daepudong Intercontinental Ballistic Missile ICBM, was successful. I was hoping that it would fail again, but it didn't.
But it's an old Soviet four-stage design, is it not? We're talking about 50-year-old technology here.
Yes, that is true. But because North Korea was, you know, it was North Korea's spectacular failures in the past, that this is considered a success.
But the fear is that they'll be able to deliver a nuclear warhead, that this has nothing to do with satellites, etc. This is a missile test, and then the next stage would be if they could put a nuclear warhead on it, then there'd be some real justification to be concerned. That, of course, leads you to ask where their nuclear program's at and what those two tests achieved. So what's yours?
Right. Yeah, well, the real issue actually is also proliferation. It's not that we feel that their program is so advanced. It's that North Korea is known to be a serial proliferator, and we are worried about them succeeding with missile technology and being able to transfer to foreign actors, other countries. That's the real issue, I believe.
But isn't that a two-way street? My understanding is that the Pakistan's AQ Khan network are the ones that shipped a lot of technology to North Korea. So give us a sense of the proliferation network. It seems to be a two-way street.
Yes, it is a two-way street. It is true that, particularly in terms of North Korea's uranium enrichment program, you know, there's a whole debate on where it got initial technology. But yes, you're right. It is from AQ Khan network. But in the past, I mean, you remember with Syria nuclear reactor, North Korea assisted to Syria, there is some concern about North Korea and Iran connection. And until very recently, also North Korea and Myanmar connection as well. You know, we cannot verify, but there was some talk. I don't know if you saw the South Korean press reports about Iranian technicians sort of being in North Korea at the time, trying to help with their missile technology, because there was some sort of a technical failure, I believe.
So if you can't do anything about this, and one of the problems with North Korea is that they operate like the delinquent child. They misbehave with the expectation that they will be rewarded for their bad behavior. That seems to be the modus operandi. So given the limitations that the U.S. have, and China, of course, has much more influence but doesn't necessarily use that influence, is there any way to go after the brains, or is this all indigenous? In other words, do they have foreign, either ex-Soviet missile and nuclear specialists working for them? What's the situation in that regard?
Well, in terms of going after the North Koreans, and let me just comment on your initial comment of that, yes, this is a time-worn strategy of acting provocatively with a missile test and a nuclear test and so on, and then in trying to sort of reap benefits afterwards. In terms of what we can do, you know, you're absolutely right. Not much. I mean, right now, I'm sure the, you know, UN Security Council is meeting in Washington. I assume that Washington and Seoul and Tokyo were pressed for some sort of, you know, an action. But what we're really looking at is just another UN Security Council presidential statement. I'm not even sure if they can get a resolution out of it. And, you know, they will be seeking to do additional sanctions on North Korea, on additional banks, businesses, and government entities that are violating sanctions. But, you know, it's just a presidential statement. And the real question, as you say, is what would China do, since China has always been the biggest impediment to any kind of meaningful action against North Korea? So this is sort of we'll see what China will do. But in terms of China's North Korea policy, will there be any change or not under the new leadership, Xi Jinping? My guess is that it will be, you know, from same old, same old. In terms of what I think they should do, it's a different question, but, you know, probably I think sanctions in something like, you know, what we did in 2005, which was very effective, was this when we went after North Korean accounts in Macau-based Banco Delta Asia. That was quite effective. But, you know, we'll continue to go after Pyongyang's illegal activities, such as currency counterfeiting, drug smuggling, and money laundering. And, you know, perhaps we could strengthen South Korea's missile defense system, or we could try to work with Koreans and the Japanese in some sort of trilateral missile defense cooperation and so on. But outside of that, with those that I just mentioned, I see Washington's options being quite limited.
Again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So focusing in on the role of China with this new leader, Xi Jinping, who I don't think is in a very strong position. There was obviously some succession problems, and the previous leader seems to want to control the defense portfolio. So it's not entirely clear, even if he wanted to do something, whether he will. And then, of course, the Chinese foreign ministry put out a fairly bland statement saying China has always insisted on bringing peace and stability to the Korean Peninsula through multilateral dialogue. We hope relevant parties stay calm in order to maintain peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. But, you know, you hear those kind of bland statements. But on the other hand, the impression I get is that the Chinese don't mind having this kind of mischievous partner in North Korea that drives the West crazy. It's a little game that they can play, isn't it?
Well, it's not that they don't mind. I do think increasingly they do mind, and they've been aggravated with North Korea, and even with Kim Jong-il, there was no love lost with Kim Jong-il. But you're right. The problem is China's and Washington's interests and priorities are just fundamentally not aligned. It's a cliche, but we say it for a reason. While we are really Washington, that is, focused on denuclearization, China is still very much focused on stability on the border and stability in the region. So because our priorities are different, they're just unwilling to really come down on North Korea because they're very risk-averse about potential instability in North Korea. So it's really hard to get China to do anything. I think our only way, and we've been trying, is to continue to talk to the Chinese and trying to change change their mindset and sort of to view this as their problem. But unless they really see it as a see eye to eye with Washington, they're not going to do much about it.
Well, so if I'm wrong, which I appear to be in suggesting that the Chinese don't mind, having this mischievous neighbor that drives the West crazy, then what explains their inability? You're saying that they find they're aggravated by the North Koreans. They do an awful lot of trade with South Korea. It would make a lot of sense if there were direct rail and road links from South Korea to China because of the trade. I understand that there is a big refugee problem on the Chinese side of the North Korean border from people who are defecting and hiding out there. So it's not as if the Chinese don't know that there's a failed state on their border. I guess is what you're saying, Sumi Terry, is that they just don't want to upset this tenuous situation. Otherwise, a collapse would mean what to the Chinese?
Exactly. They prefer status quo because instability would bring potential collapse of the regime. And what that would mean is flood of refugees going to China. I mean, you have to remember in mid-1990s, during the famine years, there were many North Korean refugees that escaped to China. And that's what they fear. And in a potential collapse scenario and potentially unified Korea scenario, which would mean South Korean-led unification, they would not have this buffer zone anymore by the North Koreans. What would then have is unified Korea that's very U.S. friendly and potentially with U.S. troops still on the Korean Peninsula. And remember, the last time during the Korean War, Chinese absolutely just didn't want that. That's why we had the Korean War with China's intervention. So what they prefer is a status quo, even though they're not quite happy with how North Koreans are acting. This is a preferable scenario for them.
So why can't the U.S. give the Chinese guarantees that they wouldn't put troops on the Yellow River, that if the North collapses, that they would work for a smooth transition and give aid which would be needed and help China out with the refugee problems? I mean, that seems to be a win-win.
But they will still be facing unified Korea that's U.S. friendly. Versus a, China-friendly North Korea on the border. But as you were suggesting, American government officials have been trying to do that, even during Track 2 meetings and so on. What we've been trying to emphasize is at least transparency, and so that there's no miscommunication or misunderstanding, that should there be a collapse, maybe we can work something out. You know, we don't mean to intervene. We don't need to have U.S. troops going to go up the north of the DMZ and so on. And even if it's not a two-way street in terms of a dialogue, it's very difficult to talk to the Chinese about this issue because they don't even want to talk about potential collapse of their ally. What we are trying to emphasize, at least for sort of transparency's sake, that hey, don't misunderstand us. This is what our intention is, and we don't intend to, you know, occupy North Korea and so on. So we are trying to do that, but it's a very, very difficult issue. It's just been an ongoing issue for the last two decades, and everyone recognizes that China holds a card, a very important card, so we've been trying to talk to the Chinese.
Well, then what are the chances of a collapse? Because my understanding is that in many ways we have got the whole situation wrong in the West, that we look upon the North Koreans as the hermit kingdom, this Stalinist communist regime. And in many ways it's not a left-wing or ultra-left-wing regime. It's a ultra-right-wing regime, more in common with the fascist Japanese regime under Emperor Hirohito in the 1930s, with the worship of the emperor. That explains why this one family are worshipped so much. So at least that's my understanding, that that's the fundamental, that we don't even recognize the true nature of this regime. And the second question would be, I understand that it is being slowly undermined from within through smuggling from in and out of China. People get DVDs and CDs, music and television from the South. They recognize that their neighbors to the South, their brethren to the South, have an incredibly high standard of living, etc. So what's the trajectories? On the one hand, you've got this emperor worship business with the family, the Kim family, the paradox of a communist dynasty. But on the other hand, they're out of step with history and they're slowly being undermined from within.
Right. Now, first of all, in terms of the the potential stability, instability of the regime, and when would it collapse? Obviously, no one knows that. But I will tell you, and a lot, you know, some folks suggested that because of this whole emperor-like dynastic, you know, what you just described, that Kim Jong-un has firmly consolidated power, and the regime is stable. I wouldn't go as far as just to say that. You have to remember, he's still only year one of Kim Jong-un in power, just 28, 29-year-old. You also have to remember that Kim Jong-un lacks the revolutionary credentials that his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, earned as a guerrilla fighter against the Japanese. And unlike his father, Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un does not have a decade or more than a decade of training and preparations for the job which Kim Jong-il had. And without serving a day of military service, he was made four-star general. So he has a lot to prove, and this is why he did this missile launch also. He had, particularly after the spectacular failure in April, he has a lot to prove, and he still is in the process of consolidating. If you look at several purges that's been going on in North Korea right now, there's just one picture of, you know, the pall bearers. The guys were holding Kim Jong-il's casket in the funeral. The whole left side of those generals are now gone. So there's a lot of changes going on. And so I don't think anyone knows for sure exactly what's going on in North Korea. So it's not, you know, I wouldn't say that he has firm hold on power. We just have to see. And as you mentioned, in terms of information penetration, information coming through the Sino-North Korea border, this is a serious issue for North Korea. One of the pillars of stability in North Korea has always been through this information control and monopoly on information, as well as ideological indoctrination and obviously the security apparatus and foreign assistance from China. But information monopoly on information was a very important pillar of stability, and that it has been eroding for some time. You've talked to all these North Korean defectors. All these guys have seen smuggled South Korean videos, soap operas, and so on. I've spent a lot of time with North Korean defectors, and I'll tell you that, you know, these guys are more on top of the latest South Korean, you know, soap opera and movies and movie stars than, you know, I am. So this is a real issue, and you know, some people also question, is Kim Jong-un a reformer or not? Would he reform like Deng Xiaoping, China? And the problem is, true reform would mean opening, and opening would mean more information coming through. And this is really a weakness for the regime right now.
Well, Sumi Terry, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a general who wants to cut the Pentagon's budget.
Someone to make reports to tell me how my money's spent, to cook my stains and draw my blinds, so I can't tell what's really there. And all I need's a great big congratulations. Strikes now, so it would strike in me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lieutenant General Robert Gard, who's the chairman of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and a former executive assistant to two secretaries of defense. He, along with Brigadier General John Johns, who's the former director of human resource development for the Army General Staff, he's taught at West Point and at the Naval Academy. together, you have an article at CNN, General Guard, with General Johns about the Congress getting real about cutting Pentagon spending. Strikes one as a bit of a heresy. Normally, military men always want more. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, I think it's probably a fair generalization, but you've got to remember that our previous chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, said that our greatest security threat was our economic situation and budget deficit.
Well, is the sequestration then, even though it's a blunt instrument, is that the only way the defense budget's going to be cut?
I hope not. If we could get the Congress to start appropriating funds for defense programs based on security needs instead of the needs of their states and districts, we could save a lot of money right off the top.
Well, but that goes back to President Eisenhower's warning in his farewell address in 1960 about the military-industrial complex. In the original draft of the speech, he called it the military-industrial congressional complex and took that out in deference to the Congress. But that's been an eternal problem, hasn't it been, that the Congress pressures the Pentagon and you end up buying stuff that's, as you've written in your article in CNN, that we're going to be building new toys that are going to be kept in the garage.
Yes, that's right. I mean, look at the F-22 fighter. It hasn't even been used in Afghanistan. It was a fighter designed to combat air-to-air, the next generation Soviet fighter that's never been built.
And the F-35 is even worse in as much as they've tried to give it a multiple missions. And at my understanding, having spoken to two of the designers of the F-16 and the A-10, which are the successful American planes, the F-16 being the one that the F-35 is supposed to replace, it doesn't even do as well as the F-16 by all measures. And it's all to do with this stealth business. And apparently you can buy for about $10 million from Russia a radar that picks up all of these stealth planes.
Yeah, I think stealth's oversold myself. And as you suggest, it's quite costly. And if in fact, stealth does give us some marginal advantage. All of the planes don't have to be stealth aircraft. You can just have a few for whatever mission you plan to use it on that would require stealth.
So given that this fiscal cliff argument, I mean, first of all, the very framing, the semantics of surrounding the fiscal cliff are somewhat hyperbolic at the very least. There is no real crisis, but it's one of those crises that have been generated that the press have gone along with. But it's really, as you point out in your article, more reflecting the lack of political will, not rational planning. Since when have we had rational planning in Washington?
Well, if you look for really objective rationality, probably never.
So what are you asking for then, General Guard?
Asking for a realization on the part of the members of our legislature that we are in fiscal trouble at the present time with the growing debt, and they need to address it in the best interests of the country, not the best interests of maintaining jobs in their states and districts.
And in terms of the cuts that you're talking about that need to be made, as opposed to the blunt cuts across the board that the sequestration would do, is there anything that gives you hope that there are these rational discussions going on? Because, for example, if you cut the F-35 program out, it's going to cost $1.6 trillion over its lifetime. It alone, that one program, takes up 38% of the entire procurement budget. So that seems to me to be the ultimate in low-hanging fruit.
Well, certainly the F-35C could be cut, the naval version. You know, this goes back to the McNamara era when they tried to produce an aircraft for all the services and it didn't work out. The F-18, E, and F served perfectly well. You can save over $16 billion over 10 years if you just cut the F-35C.
So who's listening to this argument? I mean, there's got to be a constituency out there that has powerful lobbying powers when they are able to push through these programs that don't work. I mean, there's nothing more ridiculous than the F-22, this latest fighter that we have, that it's been grounded more often than it's flown. It's never been used in Afghanistan, as you just pointed out. Its pilots are blacking out because the oxygen system doesn't work, and their pilots have been killed and planes have been lost as a result. And it cost a fortune. So we have the manifest evidence that these expensive programs are providing planes that don't fit the missions of the 21st century, cost a fortune, and don't work. And yet the power seems to be on the side of business as usual, as opposed to a wake-up call here.
Yeah, that's what's so frustrating. I mean, even when everyone takes a bow toward the fact that we are in fiscal difficulty and we need to be more responsible, it's a kind of not-in-my-backyard syndrome. And then, of course, influential members on the Hill support each other's programs so that they can get some support to get the thing through. We're also acquiring weapons in large numbers before we ever finish testing them. The ground-based mid-course missile defense system, of course, is the poster child. When President Bush ordered its deployment in 2004, and so we have those interceptors in Fort Greely and Vandenberg Air Force Base, and we haven't had a successful test since 2008.
And these are supposed to stop North Korean missiles that don't yet exist.
And Iranian missiles.
That, yeah.
In the case of the F-35, we will not even begin operationally testing the aircraft until 2017. By then, we will have purchased more than 350 of them. We've had only developmental testing. The literal combat ship, we will have purchased 20 of 55 before we complete developmental testing.
Well, already that ship, the literal combat ship, costs a fortune. My understanding is that because it's bonding steel and aluminum, it's leaking because of electrolysis, and it also veers off course. So there are tremendous problems with that ship.
Well, that's the problem with buying before you find out if it works. We actually canceled some $50 billion worth of weapons before a single one was online in the previous decade. So this certainly is a place where one can find a substantial saving.
Again, I'm speaking with Lieutenant General Robert Gard, who's the chairman of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the former executive assistant to two secretaries of defense. He, along with General John Johns, a former director of human resource development for the Army General Staff, who's taught at West Point and at the Naval Academy, have an article at CNN, Get Real and Cut Pentagon Spending. Let's turn to the other big low-hanging fruit here in terms of cutting the budget, and that is that the Pentagon is expected to spend more than $700 billion on nuclear weapons over the next 10 years. And the former head of the U.S. Strategic Command, General James Cartwright, has called for drastic cuts in nuclear weapons. saying that the stockpile is beyond our needs. What is it we're really trying to deter? Our current arsenal does not address the threats of the 21st century. The program is based more on ideology than security. So walk us through that, but that low-hanging fruit.
Well, what we have now is guidance to the strategic command that comes from the previous administration because the implementing instructions for the nuclear posture review under President Obama have not yet been issued. And you may recall a leak from the classified version of the nuclear posture review during the Bush 2 administration postulated the possibility of our initiating the use of nuclear weapons against as many as 5 countries should they be developing weapons of mass destruction. So here we have a directive to the operator to be prepared to preempt 5 countries with nuclear weapons. And a lot of the targeting guidance previously, which is still in effect, is to attack large numbers of targets in those countries against which we are programming our nuclear arsenal. Now, hopefully the president very soon will issue implementing instructions for the unclassified nuclear posture review that was issued during his first term. And that posture review said that it was highly likely that we could continue the deterrence mission with far lower numbers of nuclear weapons. Why, for example, do we need to build a whole new facility to produce plutonium pits for nuclear weapons when the Scientific Advisory Committee just came out with the conclusion that the plutonium pits would last for 150 years? So why spend, and Lord knows how much it'll end up costing, it was a few $100 million in the initial estimate, it's up over to $5 or $6 billion now. The administration has asked to postpone it for 5 years. Both the House and the Senate Defense Authorizations Committees put money in to start the study, and the design isn't finished yet, to go ahead and build that at Los Alamos. Now, we simply don't need that. There's low-hanging fruit for you.
Well, and I know it's, I used to work at Los Alamos. I know that to some extent we're talking about kind of academic welfare here, because the idea that you need more plutonium pits when during the so-called peace dividend, so many weapons with the agreements that were made as the Soviet Union was, before the Soviet Union collapsed, plutonium lasts for 25,400 years. That's its half-life. So there's tons of plutonium pits already sitting in warehouses. I mean, my understanding is, if anything, there's a shortage of tritium. So what the hell are they doing? Why do they start building a new facility to make more plutonium pits? That's
well, it was the whole nuclear thing is kind of a ideological hobby horse on the part of certain influential members of Congress, who, by the way, receive very large campaign contributions from the nuclear lobby of the companies that actually are producing the delivery vehicles and so forth. So it's all wrapped up again in that military-industrial congressional complex. You're absolutely right. As I understand it, the first draft did include the word Congress, but unfortunately it was taken out.
apparently by Brother Milton, who I believe wrote it. But as I say, that was back in 1960, and here we are in 2012. Actually, we're at 12-12-12 today. It's, if you're superstitious, it's apparently a strange day today. So let's try and end on some kind of positive note here, General Gard, and not wring our hands about, you know, this sort of unstoppable juggernaut where, in the name of defending the country, we're bankrupting it. And I think, as you rightly point out, the real challenge here, when you cite Paul Kennedy's book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, is the extent to which the American Republic will survive the empire. I mean, that's the debate we should be having, surely.
Yes, I agree. And, of course, Osama bin Laden, who wanted us to get involved in military conflicts in Arab states, had certainly succeeded. That is the source of a significant amount of the current deficit that we have, and we have to do something to arrest the growth of that. We're not going to be able to wipe it out by any means in the near term, but we certainly cannot allow it to go on at the pace it is currently. Hopefully, more sober heads will prevail. The president is taking a fairly strong position now that he's been reelected on some of these issues. In fact, Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, just stated yesterday that if certain provisions in the House Defense Authorization Bill end up in the final version, that he will strongly recommend a veto.
And that's the pork barrel from the Congress. Well, I hope you're right, General Gard, and I thank you for joining us here today.
Well, it's been my pleasure talking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lieutenant General Robert Gard, who's chairman of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and a former executive assistant to two secretaries of defense. He, along with Brigadier General John Johns, is a former director of human resource development for the Army General Staff, who's taught at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, the Air War College, at the Army War College, and the Naval Academy. Also co-wrote the article at CNN, Get Real and Cut Pentagon Spending. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and I'll answer your questions. The conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.